You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 6, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, labor's legitimacy crisis under Trump. Barry Eidlin, assistant professor of sociology at McGill University, on his piece in Jacobin. Also on the program today, Trump threatens North Korea, says they're bad. Trump's voter fraud commission may have violated the law. And the EU hits Google big time. And yet another reason to hate Chris Christie. Yes, true. Also on the program today, no surprise, White House threatens CNN via its potential merger by its parent company with AT&T. And Hobby Lobby fined for buying illegal artifacts that could have possibly funded ISIS. Yeah. Noah's Ark, meanwhile, is sinking because of atheists. And the right wing want more from McConnell's repeal and replace, further endangering child care coverage. All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, on today's program. Donald Trump, as you know, is in, I guess he was in Poland today. We will get to some of the coverage of him there. Reading off of speeches that were, I don't know, a little bit odd, and then commenting on them as he does. Expressing that things must have been bad when they were fighting World War II, and that it was hard.
Tight spot for everyone.
It's tough stuff.
But
it was hard.
Look, the important thing, aside from the... Sorry about that. The important thing is to keep in mind, I mean, obviously, he's going to be meeting with Putin tomorrow at the G20 summit. The important thing to keep in mind is that there is an ongoing negotiation happening amongst the Republican Party to destroy health care. And while that's going on, and we'll get into the details in a bit, but you must understand that there is one thing that is driving this. It is not some notion of how to improve healthcare, insurance, or coverage. They don't care. They don't care. There is one thing that is driving it. So much, though, that Paul Ryan is cutting commercials about the one true reason behind healthcare, and that is they will have a permanent tax cuts, not the kind that sunset like during the Bush administration after 10 years because it's not done because it's not deficit neutral and whatnot, and they did it through reconciliation. Permanent tax cuts, the likes of which have not been seen since their messiah of sorts, Ronald Reagan, passed a package of tax cuts in 1986. Here is Paul Ryan's, I guess, a tourist endeavor to express just how monumentous this would be.
Once in a generation, there's an opportunity to do something absolutely transformational. That moment is here. We are going to fix this nation's tax code once and for all.
Pause it for one second. First off, they couldn't juice the applause at all because it's just people are just like, I won't see any of those tax cuts. We need to double up on like
the 90s synth music because this crowd seems a little tired.
They're at the National Manufacturing Summit, and all these people are like, we're probably not going to see much of this. I wouldn't be going to crap like this if I was rich enough to have the tax cuts you're offering. But go continue.
All.
What happened?
Three, double the standard deduction and simplify things to the point that you can do your own taxes on the form the size of a postcard.
Wow.
Let me say that again. We're going to cut taxes.
Hold on. You got to rewind this. You got to rewind this. They apparently, I think they also have a voice in the background that apparently is like as if it was on TV. And you can hear the directors in the background going like, I want to see that again.
There's a few good sound effects in this. Yeah, listen closely.
All right, roll back just a little bit more.
Simplify things to the point that you can do your own taxes on the form the size of a postcard. Let me say that again. We're going to cut taxes. These reforms, these tax cuts, they need to be permanent. Businesses need to have confidence that we won't pull the rug out from under them. They need the certainty from permanent tax cuts to hire more workers, to invest in their businesses, and to plan for the future. We are going to get this done in 2017. Get in this fight. Help us get this done. Help us make this difference.
You know, they added those last three lines. That was not in the speech.
Clearly.
That is not get in this fight.
Help us create the Hunger Games. Help us do the purge. Poor people to murder. We got to do this now.
This is what healthcare is about. And this is why I think the Senate's going to end up passing it. The repeal and replace. Because at the end of the day, it is about taxes. And that's why they live and breathe. To cut taxes for wealthy people. And to do so in a permanent fashion. In a way like their saint, Ronald Reagan. Meanwhile, I should tell you, if you're watching this, you know that I am clean shaven for the first time in probably a week. I haven't been doing haze that much. I've been having to go out of town a little bit and not as available. So I didn't shave for like a week. Was I terrified when I went to shave last night? No, because I've got my Harry's razor. For decades, one big razor company has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers.
They've been ripping people off.
So Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who were fed up with getting ripped off, started Harry's to fix shaving. And Harry's knew there was only one way to ensure quality, so they bought their own blade factory. By taking less profit, selling directly to you over the internet, Harry's offers their blades at half the price, just $2 a blade compared to the four or more you'll pay at the drugstore. You know what I love about Harry's. I get a great shave, and frankly, it's not as expensive as the other one.
I save some shekels. Hello.
But also, I have to say, I also don't like to shop for stuff. So if I can just sign up, send it to me when I need it, boom. Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades, they're giving you a free trial set for free. That's why they call it free. Just cover the $3 of shipping. Your free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. That's a $13 value for you to try. Stop messing around. Get started with Harry's today by claiming your free trial offer. $13 value for free. Just cover the shipping. To get your free trial set, including a razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, shave gel, go to harrys.com/majority report right now. That's harrys.com/majority report. Also, I spoke to you about, did I tell you guys that trip I took to a breather?
Yes, you did.
Okay. So I met the guy. He's been with the company since the very early days, apparently. And I want to check out things that we're promoting. There were two different breather offices within like a 4-block radius of here. So what is it? Every time you need to book a meeting or a work event, there's a whole set of potential problems to consider. What's the most convenient location? Will it feel professional? Will there be good Wi-Fi? Breather has beautiful, inspiring workspaces for your offsites, your team meetings, your client meetings, or even individual work. And the best part is you only pay for the time that you need, a month, a day, even an hour. There's no minimums, no commitments with Breather. They own all their own spaces, so you get excellent, consistent experience every time. Breather is in LA, New York, San Francisco, Palo Alto, Boston, Chicago, DC, Toronto, Montreal, and London, and they're growing. I've spent time, I guess, in Boston, New York, and LA, and San Francisco. But if Breather existed in LA, it would have dramatically changed my experience. Because you drive 2 hours across town for a meeting, and then you're like, where am I going to work? I got to go to a crappy coffee shop,
right,
with every other guy who's sitting on their computer trying to write their script that's going to make them $1 million.
Do not blame the traffic for your failed comedy career.
There you go. But with Breather, you could just go into a workspace at an office, private office, and it's cheap. It's all app based. You can book it, I think, like up almost to the minute you go. Google, Apple, Facebook employees use Breather for their offsites and team meetings, and they already have gorgeous offices. Because apparently there's a lot of, psychological studies that say if you go into a different location, it helps your, ideating.
Your ideating?
I don't know. Don't overpay for space you don't need. Book a Breather space for the time you need it and spend hundreds, not thousands. Try Breather right now, and you'll receive $100 off your first booking when you go to breather.com/majority. That's $100 off your first booking when you go to breather.com/majority. And don't get fooled. I mean, $100 off, the two places that were within 4 blocks of here for an hour were significantly less than $100.
I saw one yesterday in Manhattan, and it was very conveniently located to many a place that I've worked.
Breather.com/majority. Breather.com/majority. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, be talking to Professor Barry Eidlin. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Barry Eidlin is an assistant professor of sociology at McGill University and wrote a piece in Jacobin, Labor's Legitimacy Crisis Under Trump. Welcome to the program, Barry.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, all right, I think broadly speaking, people understand that labor is has got a problem. And labor had a problem during the Obama administration. It's had a problem really in this country for the past, at the very least, couple of decades, probably a little bit more than that. But tell us specifically under the Trump administration, what are we looking at that is going to increase the I guess, obstacles and increase the challenges for organized labor?
Yeah. So in the very in the near term, you know, we're talking about you know, fairly dramatic policy reversals. So what I talk about in the article, you know, the new appointees to the National Labor Relations Board are going to reverse some of the more pro-labor decisions of the Obama era. There's you know, various rollbacks of health and safety and that kind of stuff. But that's really par for the course when you have a transfer of power from Democratic to Republican administrations. One of the first things that Republican administrations do is roll back some of the pro-labor decisions of the Democratic president. The problem is that the overall trajectory, as you mentioned at the outset, is downward. And why is and the key thing we need to ask is why is that? And the reason is that labor policy simply is viewed as sort of special interest policy for a Democratic Party constituency, not as sort of basic rights for workers to have decent lives, for example. And so political football.
Before we get there, I just want to walk through it because you do introduce some of these challenges up front. And so we do have the standard rollbacks that we would anticipate with a Republican administration where you say the threshold for overtime. It appears that Trump's labor secretary wants to retain the Labor Department's legitimate control over that. They just want to drop it back down.
So, at
the very least, structurally there. But there are a couple of things that we should say that I think are just important for people to have in mind so they understand the scope of this challenge. Structurally, particularly with Gorsuch, and I mean, we don't even need Anthony Kennedy at this point to retire, though he's contemplating it, that are going to impact the structural implications of. And so I want to talk about, like, you know, what
as the right to work laws,
right to work laws, agency fees. Just talk briefly about that, just so that people understand that this is not just a threat that can be reversed for workers and for labor broadly speaking, but for institutionalized labor.
Yeah. So over the past few years, there's been a revival of states passing what are called these right to work laws, which basically makes it possible for union for workers who are represented by a union in their workplace to opt out of paying for the cost of representing them. And so that basically is a way of defunding unions you know, hobbling them down with a lot of bureaucratic paperwork and basically, you know, then what you were mentioning with Gorsuch and the Supreme Court is that there's there was a near miss with the which would have imposed a right to work law on the entire public sector, essentially, that was that was missed because Scalia died last year. But then with Gorsuch, there's a new case that's making its way through the courts that is going to basically reprise that same argument that that could basically hobble a lot of public sector labor unions.
And Friedrichs was that former case, and I think this audience has got to be familiar with that name because we bring it up every time we have a celebration about Antonin Scalia's timely passing. And the one that's coming in the future is Janice v. AFSCME. And that's
Janice,
the one that has, and you cite this in your piece, the anticipation of Gorsuch coming to the Supreme Court and the anticipation of Janice making its way through the court system caused the SIU to make an announcement that they were going to cut their budget, annual budget, by 30%.
Yes. So on the one hand, before the Friedrichs decision, they were saying we need to go big. And then after... after Trump's election, they're saying we need to pull back. So we're getting some mixed messages, certainly from SEIU. Labor's message basically in this period has been very much in disarray. You know, there's certain segments that are trying to sort of do this, constructive engagement kind of thing. There's some, like the building trades, that are just really, going meeting with Trump and, being really excited about, building more pipelines. And then you have other parts of the labor movement that are, in fact, sort of trying to take a hard line and actually, develop a progressive vision that, to counter what Trump's trying to do.
You mentioned that Trumka of the AFL-CIO and Randy Weingarten, the head of the AFT, which is one of the two big American teachers unions, are sort of tentatively, there's some measure of constructive engagement, I guess, if you will, from them. What do you think that calculation is? I mean, because I think people don't fully appreciate the transactional nature sometimes of these unions and the way that they perceive, what they have to do. I'm not saying I agree with it. In many respects, I don't. But articulate that for us, if you could.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think particularly in the sort of contemporary form that unions have taken, they rely a lot more on this kind of day-to-day deal-making with power brokers in Washington, which has always been a part of the labor movement. The difference is the proportions, right? And so I think that and the context in which it's happening. So unions rely, they want to get policies implemented. They want to get interpretations of policies implemented. There's this sort of nitty gritty day to day work of government that is, important and real. And you can't just sort of will that away. The problem is losing sight of the broader context and how that shapes how those day to day transactions happen, right? So that's the context that means that, a considered conservative Republican like Richard Nixon, operating in the late 60s and 70s, implements policies that are further to the left of the progressive Democrat Barack Obama in the 2010s.
So then you go on to talk about the particularities, I should say, of labor's current challenges. You said one is... you say dealing with the Trump administration requires the analyzing of those particularities of labor's current challenges, both in the United States and within the broader context of what's happened to labor movements in the global north. And second, it requires assess labor unions' eroding ability to shape and mobilize their workers' political identities. And let's put a plug in that one, because that one, I think, is really what your piece fundamentally is about, and which really interests me. Mm-hmm. But just talk about that first part. Like, are there, is that particularity, the idea that, like, look, you've got to both balance the idea that there's that labor unions have been weakened and that they have a responsibility to try and get the best they can for their members, and that may require that transactional behavior, and that... It limits the flexibility, it seems to me, that unions have.
So you're talking about the particularities of the U.S. situation. Is that what you're?
Yeah.
That's what you're referring to. Yeah. So I mean, the U.S. situation is particular in the sense that it's probably one of the more dire situations. I mean, union density, as your listeners know, is under 7%. Probably under 6% in the private sector, and it's around 10% in overall. So there's just a bigger crisis in the U.S. relative to the rest of the world. But there's part of this overall pattern of decline. I think where the U.S. The U.S. also has this problem, like I was mentioning earlier, of just having a very fragmented labor movement that, is not really speaking with one voice, even when faced with these kind of primordial challenges to its very legitimacy. And it's particularly hobbled by the by this sort of dependent relationship on the Democratic Party for achieving any. So basically where the only way to make any sort of gains involves sort of seeking favors from sympathetic politicians, getting the right ones elected, right? And that even goes back, you know, that goes back, you know, like with the fight against Scott Walker in Wisconsin in 2011 was a classic example where they have a mass mobilization and then basically channel that into trying to get a Democrat elected who doesn't even say he's going to repeal the legislation that they're protesting about.
Right.
That sort of, so, and that's been reproducing itself. That's been, you know, we've been seeing that over and over again. You know, I think that there are some rumblings, you know, of something different, you know, particularly, you know, now that, you know, Bernie Sanders has sort of like become this much more prominent public figure in the political sphere, that's sort of changing some of the discussion, but that's still this sort of long-standing problem in the American, that's particular to the American case.
Well, let's talk about that dilemma of being perceived as a special interest group within the Democratic Party, I guess, or the Democratic Coalition.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that's basically, that comes out of my research comparing the U.S. and Canada, basically, and which as your listeners might know, has union density that's about 3 times higher than it is in the United States, despite having a lot of similar, you know, social and economic, a lot of social and economic similarities.
And let me ask you, just in terms of that comparison, how does Canada have an equivalent to like a Taft-Hartley? Is there the same structural limitations or statutory limitations on Canadian unions, or are they more favorable?
Well, currently labor law in Canada is more favorable. So a great contrast is, so while the U.S. Supreme Court is debating Janus v. AFSCME and the Friedrich decision, which is about sort of using the First Amendment and this sort of perverse reading of free speech rights to eviscerate unions. In recent years, the Canadian Supreme Court has issued these decisions that declares unionization and the right to strike as part of Canadians' constitutional rights.
Okay.
Right. So so that's sort of a nice sort of counterposition. The thing that I need to emphasize, though, is that this is, again, we need to look at the broader context, and that these laws and these interpretations of laws reflect rather than cause the weakness or strength, right? So a lot of the laws in Canada that improve, so Canadian labor law used to be worse than the U.S. and got better. And the improvement happened after massive mobilizations in Canada in the 1960s that surpassed what we saw in the U.S. Whereas in the U.S., you had sort of these upsurges in the 60s and 70s that didn't reach that same level, but they were kind of dismissed as, you know, there was a lot of writing at the time about the blue collar blues. So it sort of dismisses sort of like individual worker alienation, not the sort of crisis of industrial relations like it was in Canada.
Hmm.
So that's sort of, so I think it's important for your listeners to understand that focusing on the laws really misses the story, because it's really about the sort of level of mobilization and legitimacy for labor that is sort of driving the push to improve the laws, or at least safeguard the laws, rather than undermining them. And, you know, and that's the same with the right to work laws now. The reason that, the passage, this new wave of right to work laws in the U.S., you know, there's been 5 or 6 states now in the past 5 years after a period of dormancy of passing these laws, is this is sort of the moving in for the kill.
Right.
After a period of weakness. So I think that it's important to make that distinction, that focusing on these laws and we need to change these laws is missing the big story.
It's literally putting the cart before the horse, I guess.
Yes, exactly.
All right. So talk, you mentioned that what is most indicative of the problems that union has as being perceived as special interest groups is illustrated in the Fight for 15 movement, which has mm-hmm. been fairly successful, I think. I mean, you know,
yeah,
fairly.
Absolutely.
But explain why that's indicative of a problem that unions have.
Yeah. So what's critical to highlight there is something that one of my colleagues, Jake Rosenfeld, has talked about in some detail, is that you have this movement that's, you know, I certainly have some criticism about it, but as you say, it's been, you know, quite successful. I mean, the idea that $15 an hour is going to be the target that everyone's talking about, like even like 3 years ago, was unthinkable. So we need to, you know, really highlight that as a very significant victory. But but even though labor has essentially been at the center of that, very few people are aware of it. And that's because the unions involved, particularly SEIU, have actually gone to great lengths to conceal their role. And that is symptomatic of this fear that, you know, if it becomes known that this is a sort of union-backed effort, that sort of delegitimizes it, right? The fact that labor is behind it sort of somehow makes it a less valorable cause. And so they actually try to hide the fact that they're involved. So even when they win these victories, people aren't aware that it's a labor victory.
I mean, people should really just take a moment to sort of take that in. That is a real problem, because it's mm-hmm. a real problem, not that they did that necessarily, although that I think is problematic, because I think your argument is that that is sort of self-defeating in some respects, but it's also a problem that they feel they need to. And it's also a problem if they feel they need to, and they're correct. Like mm-hmm. that if having been, if the Fight for 15 was more prominently associated with the SEIU, and I'm not talking about how many dollars or how many organizers they had, if all the actual relationship was the same, but just that mm-hmm. there was a greater awareness that SEIU was, at the very least, you know, part of the engine driving this, that it would mm-hmm. inhibit their success. That's bad. I mean,
yeah, and I think that, I mean, and part of it is that, you know, that it is part of the crisis of labor's legitimacy, that even there's a lack of, you know, support even on the left for the labor movement, because it's sort of perceived as a sort of special interest, and a lot of, even though the actual labor movement today is, you know, one of the largest organizations of people of color, one of the largest organizations of LGBTQ people, one of the largest women's organizations, it still has this image as these sort of like, you know, old white guys, you know, who are sort of stuck in the, you know, mid 20th century. And so it's not sort of, it doesn't have support even amongst the people, you know, who should be part of its constituency.
I mean, is that, and you talk about really what needs to happen, and you quote Jane McLeavy, who we had on this program, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 months ago, about her book, but you talk about the answer to this has to be, well, multifaceted, but mm-hmm. both in the shops, essentially, where people are unionized, mm-hmm. but I imagine also on this level, like, you know, where there is a sort of almost like a 30,000 foot change in messaging as to who unions are, because just that idea that SEIU was afraid of tainting what they're doing by associating with it, that's a problem.
Yeah, no, it is. And so that's, I mean, I think the key sort of takeaway point in the article is the need to link these sort of galvanizing ideas to grassroots organization, right? So there's it's really that you can't just have sort of messaging in the abstract level, talking about the big ideas of what we're trying to do, absent some sort of on the ground presence. And then you can't just sort of have the on the ground presence without some sort of orienting idea about what we're trying to do here. That is sort of what is our transformative vision that's actually going to do something. And so that's really, so I think that really starts in the workplace right now. The thing there obviously is that the workplace is changing, and the idea of what a workplace is changing. And so there's all this talk about, you know, the gig economy and, you know, distributed production and the platform, you know, platform economy that's going to change everything. The thing there is that, yes, that is a real challenge, that, you know, getting people to recognize sort of a commonality of interest when they're dispersed all over the place. What that ignores is that that's always been a challenge for labor. That's always been a challenge for workers' movements. There isn't, you know, I mean, there's always been these time periods where the fundamental challenge that workers have often faced is creating that common identity, not just for themselves, but also creating creating their oppositional identity, creating the what we're fighting against, right? So drawing the line has been one of the fundamental tasks that labor has faced all the time. This is just the latest incidence of it. This is the latest form that it's taken.
What do you think it is that has created such a deficit in the way that workers and labor self-identifies as workers or labor? I mean, because that's the problem, right? I mean, fundamentally, people don't realize that there are other people out there who definitionally are dealing with the same set of problems that they are, or very similar, and they also don't realize that there's enough commonality there that they can band together and actually have an impact on their own individual lives.
Yeah. So I think that I mean, we have to be honest and realize that some of it is just a legacy of defeat. Like, you know, labor unions have often fought and lost. And when you lose, it hurts, and it has these longstanding impacts. And so so some of it is just, you know, fighting for workers is hard, and there's a longstanding legacy of defeat. The part that is, you know, that where there's a bit more control, you know, is the forms of political organization, the links, because I think when you look at when labor has been strong, it has not, it has fought not just by itself, it has been sort of influenced by a powerful left, right? So in the 1930s, it was the Communist Party. And, you know, there's some Trotskyist organizations like that, but there was various shades of left parties that played key critical roles in building the labor movement of that time period. And even if you go back further, you know, there are other groups that I could talk about. But that link between labor and the left was really severed in the post-war period, such that the new left of the 1960s was fundamentally different from any version of the U.S. left that had existed prior to it, in that it didn't have a base in the working class. That was something fundamentally new. And it was also a labor movement. So you had this sort of depoliticized labor movement that was cut off from this left that didn't have a base in the working class. And labor was tied to this Democratic Party that scholars of the mid-20th century know was dominated at the time by these reactionary Southern Democrats who served as a brake on social progress of all kinds, but including labor, which is, you know, why the, you know, it was the Southern Democrats that played a key role in the Taft-Hartley Act that you mentioned. So I think that, that sort of dismantling of the link between labor and the left and the tie to the Democratic Party coalition are the sort of particulars of the U.S. case that have played a role in its current weakness.
I mean, I wonder, I can't help but think that the ideas of the left being more about individual expression coming out of the 60s, in some ways, was part of the problem, in that just the way that people perceive themselves, particularly on the left, within the context of society, fundamentally changed in some way. And that, I mean, and that there became a more of an agenda of individualism, which, you know, I think it was more likely to happen on the left, right? I mean, because conformity is a bedrock principle, I think, of the right in many respects. But because this happens on the left, it begins to undercut the whole functional apparatus of unions.
Yeah, no, I think that that sort of the skepticism or awareness of sort of collective action, you know, is, and that, that is certainly part of it. It's also important to recognize that that too is a function of the sort of defeat of the 60s in a certain way, in the sense that that's the part that survived, that there was, you know, there were more sort of collective, more sort of class-oriented currents in the 1960s that were largely eliminated. And that's what, you know, and then what's left is this more individual freedom of expression kind of vision that we think of today when we think of the 60s.
So, all right. So if you got to choose who was reading this piece and, you know, the I don't know, the 1,000 people that you wanted to read this piece who could have the most impact in putting taking the idea that you're promoting here and putting it into action, who would those people be? You don't have to name the individuals, but I'm saying the, but broadly speaking, who would those people be and what would they go out and do?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I mean, my hope would be, you know, sort of the sort of ground level, you know, the ground truths of the labor movement would be sort of the stewards, the union reps, the organizers, is the people, you know, I'm not expecting, you know, the average rank and file worker to, you know, have the time to sit down and plow through 4,000 fairly dense words. I don't know. But, you know, I think that, you know, if you have this sort of, these ground troops that are actually doing the linking of these ideas to organization, that's really the key. I think that some people refer to this, as a sort of militant minority, right? That, you know, that exists in the workplaces, that are doing the organizing. You know, Jane McAlevey talks about the people, you know, who are the organizers, right? Not necessarily the activists, but the organizers. And I think that that's really the people that need to be talking about this stuff.
Barry Eidlin, assistant professor of sociology at McGill University. The piece is Labor's Legitimacy Crisis Under Trump. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks. I'm glad to be on.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half now. I mean, interesting points. And I think like this idea of just, it is sort of just shocking. I've known the SEIU was involved in Fight for 15. I think people had sort of a vague notion of it. But the idea that there would be a conscious effort not to taint it by associating it with labor institution is indicative of a real problem. And I think like that is a function of people not of having a misperception of what unions are or can be. And it has to start, I think, in unionized shops and build out from there, where people understand, you know, the points of unions and begin to see themselves within a context of a larger system rather than just a coincidence. And I mean, this is one of the things too that never actually happened, that I think was one of the early ideas behind the 99%. His name escapes me, but must have been in the early part of 2011. Occupy started, I think, in September of 2011. But in the early part of 2011, this guy, and right now his name escapes me, but he is the guy who had the idea that, like, you know, within X number of miles of Wall Street, there were a million people who had their homes destroyed. Their houses were underwater. They had lost, basically, their houses were going to get foreclosed. And the idea was to make all of those people realize they were in the same boat because of the system, of a systemic failure, as opposed to, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have bought this house here, and I overextended myself, or whatever it was. That challenge still exists, and I wonder how many, you know. I would like to look at, like, the relative TV consumption of people in this country versus, let's say, Canada, and how much that influences people's ability to see themselves as part of something else. I mean, the one thing I think, like, television more than anything else does is it's very alienating so far as it creates a significant distance between people. Everybody thinks that they're individuals because they see themselves on television.
Maybe also not in the 60s, but the Thomas Frank's first book was like One Market Under God, where he talks about how that new left counterculture started to morph with the right in the 70s and 80s.
Like the Reuben and the Yippies moved right. It and became Yuppies.
Yes. Yes, and then that all of those signifiers. Sort of like, but like at least
hyper-normalization also talks about that sort of idea that, like, I mean, what happened was individualism, this strain of individualism in this country then became expressed through consumerism.
Yeah, it just became commodified. Like, in at first in the 70s, it was at least, like, still sort of commodified in a counterculture way. And then by the 80s,
sort of like,
you're just,
that's what, I guess, Mad Men ended up being about that.
Yeah, exactly. Show. That's, and then, or the kind of pinnacle joke of when this was, like, being praised, like the perfect late Clinton era book was that David Brooks book.
Bobos and
yes,
Bobo.
Yes. And
Bobo.
That whole book was like, people are like, they're managing money for Goldman, but they like Bob Dylan. It's amazing. That was literally the thesis of that book.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half, wherein we will have fun. Just a reminder, this show exists because of its members. And why? Well, because the members realize that this show can't exist without them. And they want it to exist. So even if you're one of those folks just likes to listen to the fun half, or, I mean, to the free half, but you want the show to keep on chugging along, why not become a member? We give you the perk of some extra material, but the real perk is that we're here every day. Almost every day. Just about every day.
We're here a lot.
All the time. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. JoinTheMajorityReport.com is where you go to join the Majority Report. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Don't forget, we have our links at MajorityReportKickback.com. If you buy a crap from Amazon, buy a crap from Jet.com, check out our links there. You'll notice no difference. We get a little kickback. Also, PodcastAwards.com. Head over there, nominate the Majority Report for Politics and News and People's Choice. I said the other day, I mean, people, it's helpful to win awards. I mean, I'm coming around to it. I mean, I still, it's no Black Diamond Award, but. All right, folks, see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. We'll take your IMs as well.